Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I bet Mark Dalder always puts his phone on flight mode when he's taking a flight, don't you, Mark?
I do, and just a tip for you, if you're going to be admitting to crimes, just generally, maybe the radio, not the right place to be doing it.
Mark is a political reporter, a senior political reporter for newsroom.co.nz, one of the very best in the business, in my opinion, and he is here to talk politics for our politics segment, Politics by Night, which we do every Tuesday at around about 9:30. Where should we start, Mark? Maybe, I mean, you're in Wellington, and very exciting news for Wellingtonians upwards into nation. You might be getting a new tunnel.
Yeah, it's a really long tunnel is how it's been described. Uh-huh. A long, long tunnel.
A mega tunnel. Yeah, mega tunnel. Yeah. I like that.
It would be the country's largest motorway tunnel, or longest motorway tunnel. It would be 4 kilometres long, running from the terrace through to Kilburnie, kind of avoiding the need for a second Mount Vic tunnel by just kind of tunnelling under the entire city to make a faster or shorter path to the airport, is the theory.
Yeah. And, I mean, what would you say has the broad reaction to this idea been? Because this idea is not necessarily a novel idea, right? Like, it's been considered for quite some time, but my understanding was it was kind of dismissed out of hand as being eye-wateringly expensive and therefore not really a feasible option. And yet here it is, once again, on the table.
Yeah, I believe it was sort of considered in around 2001 by the city, but was abandoned at that time for the costs. Things are much more expensive now. So the broad reaction has been, I would say, you know, a bit of dubiousness to the government announcing that they're tasking officials at NZTA with looking into building this tunnel. Thomas Nash, the Greater Wellington Regional Councillor who deals with all the transport issues, says he thinks it would cost about $10 billion and just doesn't make sense. So that's kind of been the broad reaction to the proposal.
What's the political sense behind this?
I struggle to find one, other than the government is trying to find solutions to Wellington's transport issues, and that they are tricky issues to solve, right? It's a horrible, horrible area, the Basin Reserve, and you know, making traffic get through there more easily is tough because it's also so built up around there. So a tunnel is looked at as maybe, you know, the least disruptive way of putting some infrastructure in there, maybe, but is it realistic? The suggestion so far seems to be no. I guess we'll see what the officials at Waka Kotahi come up with.
Yeah, indeed. And that, I suppose, may gently segue us into our second topic for this evening, because I imagine that a new road would cost a lot of money, facilitate a lot of car travel, and that would not necessarily be great news for our climate change goals. Mark, how's that for a tenuous segue?
It's a tenuous segue I've used to anchor many news article about transport projects during the election, so I'll allow it.
All right. So, look, some draft proposals released for consultation by the Climate Change Commission last Monday, I think it was. This is something that you know quite a lot about, Mark. Maybe let's... you wrote a piece for Newsroom about this, going through it sort of one point after another. Should we go through and sort of maybe hit on some of the themes that you touched on in that piece? The first point, and I suppose the fundamental point of all of this, is that climate change is actually getting worse faster than we expected it to.
That's right, yeah. And the impacts are being felt in New Zealand and globally more quickly than we thought they would, at lower temperature thresholds than we thought they would. And we know that that this is not the end of it, that temperatures are going to continue to rise as long as we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that's the case for most other greenhouse gases as well. And there's no sort of serious sense that we're going to stop doing that as a globe, as a civilization, until 2050 at the earliest, and that's if you're really, really, really optimistic.
Which sounds bad, and yet there is good news here as well. New Zealand is actually at the moment performing relatively well when it comes to hitting our climate goals.
Yeah, that's right. The targets that we set are our 5-year carbon budgets. The new projections that we've had from the government and the Climate Change Commission's own projections both show us on track to meet those targets. Part of that is because there have been changes in how we calculate our emissions. Mm. So you can imagine that actually figuring out exactly how much methane the entire agriculture industry puts into the atmosphere is not an easy task, and it's a very, very complex model that does this. So as we get new data, I remember 2020, one of the changes that they made was they took into account different slopes of hills that sheep or cows might wee on, would produce different levels of greenhouse gas depending on whether it was a shallow slope or a steep slope. So we're constantly improving these models. It turns out that we were emitting less than we thought we were before, so we're going to be emitting less in the future. That's not real progress, the Commission says. Yeah. We should adjust our goals to be more ambitious in light of that so that they actually do require us to do something beyond get better at calculating our emissions. But we're doing more on electric vehicles than expected. Industry subsidies for getting rid of coal boilers and that sort of thing are pushing us along faster than we expected. And we planted a lot more pine trees in 2020, 2021, 2022, and 2023 than we thought we would. And so that kind of has brought forward some of our carbon, I guess, offset program, you could say, from where it was expected to be more later in the decade.
That point that you make about, you know, do you find that frustrating, the idea of organisations maybe playing silly buggers a little bit with definitions and calculations, and then using these updated definitions and calculations to claim that you are, in fact, you know, making real inroads and things are looking better than expected? Do you find that frustrating when you are reading through these reports and you have to call people out on things like this?
Yeah, I guess it's up to the government now on what they're going to do with this. And the other thing that's worth noting is these projections are based on where policies were at July 1 last year. Obviously, there's been a lot of change, particularly in the electric vehicle and industry subsidy space. And so with those policies gone, maybe the new set that the Climate Change Commission is going to release with their final advice on these issues of projections will be maybe a bit less rosy, a bit less optimistic.
Another point in these proposals released by the Climate Change Commission last week is that acting ambitiously on climate change could actually have, you know, social and economic benefits, I suppose what you might describe as trickle-down benefits. Talk us through this.
Yeah. So a lot of the conversation about climate action, about climate policy, stuff that we can do to reduce emissions, focuses on the cost of that.
Yeah.
And there is a cost, right? You know, building new power generation costs money. Electric vehicles are, at the moment at least, more expensive than fossil fuel vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. But the Commission's work has found actually in the net, compared to a scenario where we just don't do anything additional on climate policy, our sort of business as usual scenario from here on out, if we do follow the Commission's recommended pathway and do reduce our emissions, as a society, we will save more than we will cost. Because while there will be direct costs, the savings in terms of actually you no longer need to buy petrol or diesel to fuel your vehicle, you can do electricity and that's a lot cheaper, will come in and outweigh that. There's also a big saving in air pollution. You know, air pollution kills 3,000 roughly New Zealanders a year or contributes to their premature deaths. So by decarbonizing and getting rid of fossil fuels, including in cars, which is the sort of main source of that air pollution in New Zealand, we could be saving $2.7 billion a year in reduced health costs from hospitalization, increased productivity. You know, people can not have asthma and not be dealing with the sort of ailments that air pollution can cause. And, of course, they're just healthy and alive for longer and able to contribute sure, to the economy, but also to society and to meaningful lives for longer.
Do you think that climate change activists, I don't know, the term activist is loaded, substitute, noun of your choice in there, are doing a good enough job at selling the potential benefits of, acting ambitiously on climate change? Because you're right, I do get that sense that there is a big focus on the doom and gloom and what you're going to be losing. From your perspective as someone who reports on this sort of stuff a lot, do you think that people could be doing better in, highlighting the positives as well as having a planet?
It's a very hard balance to strike because the situation is urgent and we're not doing enough. But when you say that, people kind of tune out. They feel maybe like you're telling them off, or maybe they just feel anxious and worried. And so focusing on the positive can help. But if you don't balance it, if you don't give people their vegetables as well, you end up with maybe this utopian promise of technology is going to come and save us, and we don't need to do anything as individuals, as communities, as a country. It's all going to work out, because that's not the case either. So there is a balance to strike. I think we can have more positive messaging. There are a lot of really good developments, both in the climate policy space, but also in climate science. We're seeing, we're learning new things about the world, and that helps us respond in the right ways to best protect nature and to best protect our societies as well. So there are good news stories in there. They should be told. It's a complex issue. Yeah. Happy to come on when you have more time another day and chat about it in more detail if you'd like.
Yeah, no, that would be great, actually. We'll pencil you in. Hey, look, finally this evening, obviously, as people will be aware, there was a horrifying stabbing in Sydney. Six people stabbed to death in a busy Sydney shopping mall. The man who's been arrested for this, Andrew Cauchy, his father has been talking to the media and said that he thinks that he knows why his son did that. Andrew Cauchy is the attacker's father. Joel Cauchy is the man who allegedly committed these crimes. And Andrew Cauchy is reported to have said that his son targeted women, quote, because he wanted a girlfriend and he's got no social skills and he was frustrated out of his brain, end quote. Now, this area of misogyny and what might be described as sort of incels is something that you have reported on quite a bit, and you know quite a bit about this area, Mark.
Yeah. It's interesting because in New Zealand, since the March 15 terror attack, we've become, I guess, somewhat more aware of some of the ideologies that inspired that attack, white supremacy and that sort of thing. But more and more research is increasingly showing that for many of these terrorists, these extreme, often extreme right-wing terrorists, there is a sort of central strain of misogyny at the root of their ideology in and amongst the race theories and the anti-immigration and anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic sentiment that they also hold quite strongly. And so, to some extent, this incel movement is its own fringe movement, not necessarily the same as maybe white supremacists and neo-Nazis and things, but there are very significant overlaps, both in the spaces that these extremists occupy online, where they do radicalize one another and mobilize one another to violence, and in the ideology that they hold more generally. We don't know the specifics with this incident in terms of what the motivation really was or how the alleged attacker developed this ideology, if it was an ideology that he held. But what we've seen with research into other attacks like this is that there usually is that online radicalization component. Even with the March 15 terrorists, for example, we've now had research coming out just earlier this year where researchers have found quite an extended history of online activity in exactly these sorts of forums, discussing, this sort of ideology in quite a bit of depth before the attack was actually committed.
It's difficult to know where to come up with solutions or even things that might help in this kind of space. I suppose, you know, the broader theme of better media literacy and, you know, understanding and contextualizing things that you read online and, you know, having a bit of knowledge about where they come from and what the motivations of the people saying them and so on and so forth must be part of that. But, you know, we're talking in such broad strokes here, really, aren't we?
Yeah, it is a broad strokes problem, and there are broad strokes solutions. I think the media literacy side is one of them. You know, Finland is kind of renowned for its, they call it, you know, an inoculation program, but it really is teaching people the kinds of harmful content that they might be exposed to on the internet, mm-hmm. how that could be manipulated to seem more innocuous, and how, you know, when they see a post that talks about immigrants in this way or what have you, that might actually be leading on to something much darker than it appears on the face. The broader social solution, though, and this was the recommendation of the Royal Commission into the March 15 attack, is social cohesion, which is a big, abstract, vague idea. Mm. But broadly, we want to build a society where everyone feels included, feels like they can meaningfully participate, and basically a society where no one would want to commit a terrorist attack. It's not easy, and it's not something that, you know, you can just flick a switch on, but that's the end goal, ideally.
Great stuff. Mark Dalder from Newsroom, thanks so much for coming on, Nights. It's been nice chatting to you again.
Thanks for having me on, Emil. It was good to chat with you as well.
That's Mark Dalder. Mark is a senior political reporter for newsroom.co.nz.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.